a grove and came to the Jordan, he and all the children of Israel, and lodged there before they crossed over. So it was, after 3 days, that the officers went through the camp. And they commanded people, saying, "When you see the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh your God, and the priests, the Levites, bearing it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. Yet shall there shall be a space between you and it, about 2,000 cubits by measure. Do not come near it, that you may know the way by which you must go, for you have not passed this way before." And Joshua said to the people, "Sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow Yahweh will do wonders among you." Then Joshua spoke to the priests, saying, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant and cross over before the people." So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. And Yahweh said to Joshua, "This day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. You shall command the priests to bear the Ark of the Covenant, saying, 'When you have come to the edge of the water of the Jordan, you shall stand in the Jordan.'" So Joshua said to the children of Israel, "Come here and hear the words of Yahweh your God." And Joshua said, "By this you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Hivites and the Perizzites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is crossing over before you into the Jordan. Now therefore, take for yourselves 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one man from every tribe. And it shall come to pass, as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests who bear the Ark of Yahweh, the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, that the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off, the waters that come down from upstream, and they shall stand as a heap." So it was, when the people set out from their camp to cross over the Jordan, with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as those who bore the Ark came to the Jordan, and the feet of the priests who bore the Ark dipped in the edge of the water, for the Jordan overflows all its banks during the whole time of harvest, that the waters which came down from upstream stood still, and rose in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zaratan. So the waters that went down into the sea of Arabah, the salt sea, failed and were cut off. And the people crossed over opposite Jericho. Then the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh stood firm on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan. And all Israel crossed over on dry ground until all the people had crossed completely over the Jordan. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Please be seated. In our first lesson in this series, I sought to provide the covenantal context behind the narrative of Joshua, looking backward at the Abrahamic and the Mosaic covenants, and also forward to the new covenant. And before we dive into our text tonight, I'd like to take another look backward at two events that provide some big picture background for chapter 3. And those events are creation and Exodus. On the third day of the creation week, God divides waters to bring forth dry land. We read in Genesis 1, 9, and 10, "Then God said, 'Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear.' And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good." God proceeds on that day to cause the dry land to burst forth with vegetation that will make it amenable for the flourishing of creatures he has yet to create, including human beings. The Hebrew word translated dry land here means dry, withered, without moisture, or drained. And this same word is also used in Exodus 14, 15 through 16, just before the Red Sea crossing. We read there, "And Yahweh said to Moses, 'Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward, but lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground,'" that's the same word as in Genesis 1, "'and through the midst of the sea,'" which is the same word as sea in Genesis 1. And by echoing Genesis 1, the account of the Exodus through the Red Sea shows this significant act of redemption to also be something of an act of recreation. in which the Lord again divides waters of chaos so his people can move to a land where he will supply all their needs. And that theme recurs here in Joshua 3 as Yahweh divides the waters of the Jordan so his people may pass through on dry ground into a land of promised blessing. A land elsewhere described as like the Garden of Eden. You can look that up. It's Ezekiel 36, 35 or Joel 2, 3. Once again, there is new creation with abundant divine provision. And I mention all this to show the organic unity and continuity in the unfolding of God's saving acts on behalf of his people, a theme to which we will return in our conclusion tonight. The story that unfolds in Joshua 3 is part of the greater story of salvation that is told in the Bible as a whole. But now we want to get back to the immediate context of our passage. In our last message, which was a few weeks ago, we rehearsed the story of Rahab the harlot in Joshua 2. And that chapter ends with the two spies returning to camp and reporting to Joshua. And so we read in Joshua 2, verses 23 and 24, "So the two men returned, descended from the mountain, and crossed over. And they came to Joshua the son of Nun and told him all that had befallen them. And they said to Joshua, 'Truly, Yahweh has delivered all the land into our hands, for indeed all the inhabitants of the country are faint-hearted because of us.'" Now, this report sounds very much like the report that Joshua himself, along with Caleb, had given in their earlier excursion into the land when they had crossed over from Kadesh Barnea 40 years before this. Like Joshua and Caleb before them, these two men are confident that Yahweh would give the land into the hands of Israel just as he had promised. And it is the beginning of that divine giving that we read about in chapter 3. And we're going to consider this passage tonight under four headings. First of all, the preparation of Yahweh's people in verses 1 through 6. Secondly, the encouragement of Yahweh's servant, verses 7 through 9. The assurance of Yahweh's power, verses 10 through 13. And the wonder of Yahweh's method, verses 14 through 17. Again, the preparation of Yahweh's people, the encouragement of Yahweh's servant, the assurance of Yahweh's power, and the wonder of Yahweh's method. We begin with the preparation of Yahweh's people in the first six verses. And we see two aspects of the preparation of Israel for crossing the Jordan in these verses. First of all, we see staging and marching orders. And secondly, spiritual preparation. So beginning with staging and marching orders, first of all, we see the people arrive at the place that will be the staging ground for their crossing. We read verse 1, "Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Acacia Grove," and in the Hebrew it's the word Shittim, "and came to the Jordan, he and all the children of Israel, and lodged there before they crossed over. As they had perched across the river from the land at Kadesh Barnea 40 years earlier, now they move from Shittim to the Jordan River in preparation for the journey. We're not exactly certain of the location of Shittim, but it may have been up to about 10 miles away. And so we have on this exquisitely drawn map Shittim, and this is what they do. They move to their staging ground, and again, it's a journey of perhaps as many as 10 miles. And now they get their marching orders in verses 2 through 4. "So it was after 3 days that the officers went through the camp, and they commanded the people, saying, 'When you see the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh your God, and the priests, the Levites, bearing it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. Yet there shall be a space between you and it about 2,000 cubits by measure. Do not come near it, that you may know the way by which you must go, for you have not passed this way before.'" Now, verse 3 mentions the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh your God. Now, this is the first mention of the Ark in Joshua, but it is going to be mentioned 10 times in this chapter and 7 times in the next. It is very central to this story, so let's reflect on it a bit. So, children, you did very well in your Bible quiz this morning, so you'll get another one tonight. See if we can stump you. What three things were contained in the Ark of the Covenant? Anybody know? What's one? Not Moses' rod, Aaron's rod. You're right, it's a rod, and it was Aaron's rod was there, the rod that it budded. The Ten Commandments, the tablets with the Ten Commandments, and there was one more thing. Right, a jar of manna. Those were the three things that were carried about in the Ark of the Covenant. And as the people of Israel knew those things were there, they would be reminded of the Lord's covenant relationship with them. It was within that covenant relationship that he gave them the law, signified by the Ten Commandments, the priesthood and the sacrificial system under Aaron, the first high priest, and miraculous provisions like manna, which was described as bread from heaven. And the ark symbolized God's presence with his people, especially his covenant bond with them. It was a bond of intimate relationship. Now, this can be a bit obscured in our English translations. While the Hebrew often has the phrase that we're used to hearing, the Ark of the Covenant, there are several alternative renderings in this chapter. Verse 14 literally reads, the Ark, comma, the Covenant. And verse 17, the Ark, the Covenant of Yahweh. So closely was the Ark related to God's covenant with his people that it could even, in a sort of symbolic way, be called the Covenant, as it is in several places in this chapter. And the centrality of the ark and all its covenantal significance in this episode stresses the fact that Yahweh is leading them, and ultimately he is giving them the land. Now, Joshua will play an important role as a human leader, and military might will be involved. But any success these forces have will be due to the leadership of the Lord. According to verse 3, Levites who were priests were to carry the ark. Now, while the law said that only Levites could carry the ark, it wasn't required in the law that only the priests do it. And you need to remember that all the priests were of the tribe of Levi, but not everyone in the tribe of Levi was a priest. So there seems to be something perhaps special about this. Not just any Levite, but the priest on this occasion were to bear the ark. And listen again to the commands given to the people. When you see the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh your God and the priests, the Levites, bearing it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. Yet there shall be a space between you and it, about 2,000 cubits by measure. Do not come near it, that you may know the way by which you must go, for you have not passed this way before. So the people were to follow the Ark, but they were not to follow the Ark too closely. They were to keep a distance of about 2,000 cubits, and that's roughly 3,000 feet. So think about, say, the length of a football field. And that's where the closest Israelites would be to it, and then there'd be many, of course, behind them. Now, why was this? Why were they to keep such a distance from the ark? Well, some people think it was a way to show respect for the holiness of the ark. We know that it was dangerous to touch the ark if it was done in an improper way or by the wrong people. But that's not actually what the text here says. It gives us a reason. It says, do not come near it, that you may know the way by which you must go, for you have not passed this way before. If the people walked too closely to the ark, they wouldn't have any perspective that they needed to get the picture of where they were to go and of what an amazing thing Yahweh would do in their midst. And I thought about this, and it reminded me of when I was in college, I regularly attended home football games, which I do kind of miss. And I had friends in the marching band, and in my senior year, my roommate was the drum major. So I always watched the performance of the marching band during halftime. But my appreciation of that performance would vary depending upon where I was sitting. If I had a really good seat, so-called, way down close to the field, I could see the instrumentalists marching around. I could hear their music, but their movements made no sense to me. I could just see people moving around. But if I moved higher up into the stands and I looked down, suddenly I could see that they were very choreographed in their marching. That they would do, to me, amazing things. They would spell out words on the field or create beautiful designs on the field. And the only way I could see that was to have some distance in order to get that perspective. Well, something like that is what Yahweh is commanding here. Distance would allow the Israelites to watch the progression of the ark and to perceive the direction they were to go as they approached and crossed the river. And again, they're reminded this is a place they've never crossed before. And it would also give them a good vantage point to see the result of God's miracle when it happened. Such were their marching orders. But in addition to that, there was also spiritual preparation. And we read of this in verse 5. And Joshua said to the people, "Sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow Yahweh will do wonders among you." The word sanctify is related to the word holy. It speaks of separation from that which is common or unclean for holy purposes. And Joshua here doesn't tell the people how to sanctify themselves, but previous examples give us an idea of the kind of thing that was involved. Before Israel encountered Yahweh on Mount Sinai, they are instructed in Exodus 19 to sanctify themselves by washing their clothes and by refraining from sexual relations. In this way, the people were to prepare for the meeting of the Lord. And we're told here the reason for sanctifying themselves. For tomorrow, Yahweh will do wonders among you. And this word wonders refers to that which is beyond human explanation. We get a sense of this in its use in its adjective form, where it's translated marvelous in Psalm 78:12. Listen to Psalm 78:12 through 16, reflecting back on some of the experiences of Israel. "Marvelous things he, that is the Lord, did in the sight of their fathers, in the land of Egypt, in the field of Zoan. He divided the sea and caused them to pass through, and he made the waters stand up like a heap. In the daytime also he led them with the cloud, and all the night with a light of fire. He split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink in the abundance like the depths. He also brought streams out of the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers." When Joshua calls the people to sanctify themselves because the next day Yahweh is going to work wonders among them, they should be expecting a divine act on the magnitude of the parting of the waters of the Red Sea or the provision of water from a rock in the wilderness. And once more, they are reminded that they will be participating in something that is the work of God, not something they're accomplishing themselves. It is going to involve wonders. Well, now that the people have been instructed, Joshua gives commands to the priests that set things in motion. Verse 6, "Then Joshua spoke to the priests, saying, 'Take up the Ark of the Covenant and cross over before the people.' So they took the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people." And so the Ark is carried in front of the people as they engage in their preparations. Next, we come to the encouragement of Yahweh's servant in verses 7 through 9. Not only did the people of Israel need to prepare for the wonders before them, so did their servant leader, Joshua. Recall how the book opens with the transition of leadership to Joshua after Moses' death. Even given all his experiences with Moses, Joshua might yet wonder whether the people are ready to follow his lead. And the Lord assures him that they will. Verse 7, "And Yahweh said to Joshua, 'This day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you.'" In chapter 1, the Lord had promised Joshua, "As I was with Moses, so I will be with you." And now he assures Joshua that the people will come to know this very thing. He will make Joshua great before their eyes so that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. Now note, Joshua is not exalted because of any of his own gifts or because of any of his own strengths. He will be exalted because the people will know that Yahweh is present with him in blessing as he had been with Moses. Now, having given Joshua this encouragement, the Lord commands Joshua to continue exercising his leadership. Verse 8, "You shall command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, saying, 'When you have come to the edge of the water of the Jordan, you shall stand in the Jordan.'" Joshua has received encouragement from the Lord, and he's received commands for the priest, and now he boldly speaks to the people. Verse 9, "So Joshua said to the children of Israel, 'Come here and hear the words of Yahweh your God.'" And that brings us to the assurance of Yahweh's power in verses 10 through 13. Listen again to those verses. "And Joshua said, 'By this you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Hivites and the Perizzites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Jebusites. Behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth is crossing over before you into the Jordan. Now, therefore, take for yourselves 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one man from every tribe. And it shall come to pass as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests who bear the ark of Yahweh, the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, that the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off, the waters that come down from upstream, and they shall stand as a heap. And note how Joshua begins. By this you shall know that the living God is among you. This is the heart of God's covenant promise. I will be your God, and you will be my people. It is the Emmanuel principle, God with us. The people needed to be assured of Yahweh's powerful presence with them in order to trust that he would, without fail, drive out all those ites who were before them, those who would be, naturally, their enemies. And what was to give them this assurance? Verse 11, behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth is crossing over before you into the Jordan. And again, this is a place where it literally reads, the ark of the covenant, the Lord of all the earth, signaling a virtual identification of the Lord and the ark. Through the ark of the covenant, in a very real way, he was present with his people. And as they prepared to enter this particular land, it would be assuring for them to remember that their God, Yahweh, was the Lord not just of one little portion of territory. He was the Lord of all the earth. Now, the Hebrew word here could be translated either earth or land, but either translation would assure them that the land they were about to enter was Yahweh's domain. Now, the narrative in this chapter builds slowly with some suspense. Verse 12 gives an instruction, the significance of which will only be learned later. Now, therefore, take for yourselves 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one man for every tribe. We'll have to wait till chapter 4 to find out what it is that these 12 men will do. Meanwhile, in verse 13, we learn more specifically the nature of the wonders announced in verse 5. And it shall come to pass, as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests who bear the ark of Yahweh, the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, that the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off, the waters that come down from upstream, and they shall stand as a heap. The people knew that they were to cross the Jordan, but until now they didn't know how Yahweh would make it possible for them to do so. They were led to expect a wonder, something comparable to the parting of the Red Sea, and that is exactly what they're going to get. As soon as the priests step into the waters of the Jordan, the waters are going to be cut off upstream, and they shall stand as a heap. In the midst of this description is another reminder that Yahweh is the Lord of all the earth. Now remember that the priests are carrying the Ark of the Covenant. It is the symbol of Yahweh's guiding presence with them, and it is that which is to give them assurance. We come now to our fourth point, the wonder of Yahweh's method in verses 14 through 17. Now both priests and people obey Joshua's commands, and what happens is wondrous indeed. Beginning at verse 14, we read, so it was when the people set out from their camp to cross over the Jordan, with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as those who bore the Ark came to the Jordan, and the feet of the priests who bore the Ark dipped in the edge of the water, for the Jordan overflows all its banks during the whole time of harvest, that the waters which came down from upstream stood still, and rose in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zaratan. So the waters that went down into the sea of the Arabah, the salt sea, failed and were cut off, and the people crossed over opposite Jericho. Then the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh stood firm on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel crossed over on dry ground until all the people had crossed completely over the Jordan. Let's note a few details of this account. First of all, consider its timing as indicated in verse 15. We have a parenthetical comment there. For the Jordan overflows all its banks during the whole time of harvest. Now, this word for harvest generally refers to the grain harvest, which would take place in Canaan in late spring. Secondly, this timing was significant for what it means about the state of the river to be crossed. Commentator Ralph Davis explains, the river's floodplain is 200 yards to 1 mile wide. The floodplain was packed with tangled brush and jungle growth. The river channel was from 90 to 100 feet broad, with a depth of 3 feet at some fords to as much as 10 to 12 feet. The current was strong because of the drop in elevation, a drop of 40 feet per mile near the Sea of Galilee, and an average of 9 feet per mile overall. This means that the river Israel faced that springtime was no placid stream, but a raging torrent, possibly a mile wide and covering a mass of tangled brush and jungle growth. So here's my attempt to give a sort of a side view of what we're talking about. And we've got the Jordan River itself, which is here, and this would be 90 to 100 feet. But then above the Jordan River itself, there was this floodplain. And the floodplain, let me see here, was 200 yards to a mile wide. And the floodplain was filled with just all this tangled brush and jungle kind of growth. And so it was said that part of the trick in fording the Jordan, it was almost as difficult getting through this tangle of brush as it was to get through the river itself. And so that's sort of what we're to envision. It's not that the people just stepped down at the edge of the river. This was the floodplain. And as we see, the state of the river is described in verse 15 by the words, "The Jordan overflows all its banks during the whole time of harvest." And what this meant is that it would be humanly impossible to accomplish this crossing. And you know, God sometimes brings us to the end of our rope in order to show what He alone can accomplish in our lives. And that was the case with Israel's situation prior to their crossing the Jordan. They were to stand back, 3,000 feet back, in order to be able to see what Yahweh would accomplish. So what happened when the priest and the people obeyed? When the feet of the priest who bore the ark dipped in the edge of the water, the waters which came down from upstream stood still and rose up in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zaratan. So the waters that went down into the Sea of Arabah, the Salt Sea, failed and were cut off, and the people crossed over opposite Jordan. Now this is a most remarkable event with some similarity as well as dissimilarity with the Exodus event of the crossing of the Red Sea. Some of the language is very similar to that of the earlier crossing under Moses' leadership. We're told that the waters which came down from upstream stood still and rose up in a heap. Now, we already heard that language in the psalm that we read earlier, and we find it again as part of the song of Moses celebrating their passage through the Red Sea. In Exodus 15:8, that song includes the words, "And with a blast of your nostrils, the waters were gathered together, the flood stood upright like a heap." So the standing up of waters like a heap is a common element between these two events. However, the vantage point of those who would cross were quite different. At the Red Sea, the Israelites could observe the waters piled up on either side of them. They could look to the left, and there was a pile of water. They could look to the right, and there was a pile of water. Here at the Jordan, this heaping of the waters took place very far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zaratan. And this is Adam, and Adam was a small city not that well known, and Zaratan was better known, which is probably why they did that. So we've got Zaratan up here. Didn't spell that exactly right. And this is approximately 15 to 20 miles distance between them. So if you've ever thought that the crossing of the Jordan was just like the Red Sea, where the waters parted and the people walked through, that wasn't the case at all. 15 to 20 miles away, the waters were stopped, and they stood up in a heap. Certainly not something that they could see themselves. What the Israelites observed was the water that was rushing past them at this high flood time suddenly disappeared as it stopped flowing from the north. And think of the magnitude of this miracle. We read in verse 16 that the waters that went down into the Sea of Arabah, the Salt Sea, failed and were cut off. Now this distance from Shittim down to the Salt Sea was about another 5 miles. So we're looking at anywhere from 20 to 25 miles of suddenly empty riverbed in the River of Jordan. And that when it usually is at its high flood peak. It was truly miraculous, and it was Yahweh's miraculous provision for his people so that they could cross over toward Jericho. And cross they did, as is recorded in verse 17. Then the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh stood firm on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan. And all Israel crossed over on dry ground until all the people had crossed completely over the Jordan. This word for dry ground is different than the word dry land in the creation account, but it is a word that's used of the Exodus through the Red Sea in Exodus 14:21. So again, we have a connection between these two events. So there's a pattern that is set up at creation, and it's mirrored in acts of recreation in the crossing of the Red Sea and the Jordan River. God divides waters. He prepares a land into which he delivers his people. In Exodus and Joshua, these acts of redemption and recreation make it possible for Israel to receive its inheritance, the promised land. And this theme is picked up in the New Testament. Listen to 1 Peter 1:3-4. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. And the Greek word Peter uses here for inheritance is the word that's used in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, in reference to Canaan, that promised land, which was the inheritance of Israel. And like those believers of old, we trust in the promises of God and look forward to an inheritance. But our inheritance is not some piece of real estate in the Middle East. As the writer to the Hebrews put it here, we have no continuing city, but we seek the one to come. And even Abraham realized that the promised land was just provisional and anticipatory. For we're told in Hebrews 11:10, he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. As Peter tells us, ours is a heavenly inheritance. It is none other than the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, Revelation 21:10. And here is the great promise of the account in Joshua for us. Just as God faithfully and miraculously perform mighty acts of recreation and redemption in leading Israel through the Red Sea and the Jordan, so he will deliver us into our inheritance, the new Jerusalem in the midst of a new creation. People of God, marvel at God's past acts of deliverance and trust him for your future deliverance. This has been ever the hope of the church, which has often seen a parallel between the Jordan crossing and our eternal destiny. We sang of it in our song earlier, and we will sing of it in another great hymn, which we will sing at the end of the service, which includes these lines: when I tread the verge of Jordan, bid my anxious fears subside. Death of death and hell's destruction, land me safe on Canaan's side. Rejoice that all God's promises are yea and amen to you in Christ, and that he will surely deliver you into your eternal inheritance.